Thank you, Mr. Briggs. Probably made you a little nervous not running up here. I'm hoping this works. As I promised some people before church, you're either going to love this or hate this, what's up on the screen, and I shared it so that everyone can stream to it. If you're older than a certain age, you'll probably dislike it. If you're younger than a certain age, it'll just be like, yeah, you already know what to do. If you don't know what to do, don't worry about it. If you do know what to do, go ahead, follow the link. It will give you access to the sermon notes that I'm going to go through. And it was easier than photocopying, you know, 50 pages. And it shows off my technical flex, so that's, you know, kind of cool. But it keeps it up to date, too. So as I make changes during the day, I don't have to modify that. And for those that are pulling it up, you'll see this one's going to be a scripture-dense message. The intent here is not to hit every single scripture, but if you go to this, you can refer to them later. It's good reference material. So what I want to talk about today is ostensibly the Exodus. As Dr. Holliday spoke last week, it was inspiring. I was reading through it, and although we do it every year, sometimes you'll see things you hadn't caught before. And there were a few things that jumped out at me last time, and I thought, wow, how did I never catch that? So I really dove into it. And I'm going to change it a little bit. Instead of calling it the Exodus, I'm going to call it the extraction. Because if you think about what it was God taking these people that he had promised he would work with throughout time and pulling them out of Egypt. And it's not the only extraction that God has planned, but it's the one that we've historically witnessed. It's the one that we study and practice as we lead up to the days of unleavened bread. Today, what I want to do is I want to compare and contrast, really compare the extraction that happened with what we call the Exodus and the extraction that we look forward to when Christ returns and pulls us out of this world. Because just like every good plan that God lays down, there's a prior fulfillment and there's a successive fulfillment. And we can learn from both of those events to complement our understanding. Because arguably the Exodus happened quite a few years ago, and we have the scriptures that we read through. But there's probably a few things, as I had missed, that we don't pick up on because we hadn't stopped and thought about it. So today, I want to go through and cover seven lessons from the extraction that God executed with the Israelites and that he will execute with his holy people and his saints when Christ returns. So in order to understand it, I'm going to go to point number one. We need to understand the setting that took place. And again, remember this is a parallel between the Exodus that the Israelites went through and the extraction that God's people will go through at the end time. First principle you want to understand is that God had established the people long before, and we'll take Israel as the model, with a religious purpose. So when you look at Exodus 3, verse 6, God describes himself when he's talking to Moses as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These were ancestors that the Israelites would have understood, right? They had been there for over 400 years, or around 400 years at the time that this was taking place. And they would have lost their culture. To put it in perspective for us, if Christ were to begin the extraction process for us today, the historical equivalent would be, I am the God that brought the pilgrims to America. I am the God that brought William Bradford along with the pilgrims. In fact, it was 400 years ago this past December that the pilgrims came to Plymouth Rock. So from a historical perspective, how well do we remember and have we maintained the culture that our ancestors established? Right? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were very religious people following God. Their ancestors 400 years later were not. And in fact, that's part of that fundamental principle that they had lost that culture. Look in Exodus 3, verses 13 through 15. Pull this one up, because it's an interesting one. It was one of those that struck me when Dr. Holliday was reading through, because it was a language that I found curious. It was a reference that only made sense when you realize that these people had not thought on God for 400 years. So Exodus 3, verse 13 says, Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they asked me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. The Israelites have been living for 400 years in a horrible religious culture. They had hundreds of gods, hundreds of deities. So for them to say, who is this God that has sent you? They were trying to go, I don't know this God. Who is this guy? Is he the God of frogs? Is he the God of Nile? Who is this God that we should recognize him? Because they did not have an understanding of the true God. Compare that to now. Again, we don't know when Christ is coming back. But our ancestors, the pilgrims, came here because they wanted the freedom to worship God without the oppression of rulers and other cultures. Where are we at now? Just look at the morality we have. The fact that we're taking any semblance and shred in society of anything religious, anything God-related, and we're throwing it out. I heard a fascinating article the other, just yesterday. Read that in California there is there's a motion being pushed through the education board at the state level that while they can't have school prayers, they're trying to set up an ethnically diverse program where the children pray to the Aztec god of, I don't remember what one it was. It was one of the Aztec gods, a chant to strengthen them and make them strong warriors of the way. So here you have a system that says we can't possibly have the Ten Commandments, we can't possibly believe in the Creator God that this nation was founded on, but we would love to go after those gods that were here that horribly destroyed other cultures around them, right? So you can imagine how far the Israelites had slipped. This is important because as you go through the extraction process, God has to work with people where they're at. They were initially founded on a religious principle. In fact, you can look at it and you see that, well, I'll get to it in a second, you see that Joseph instructed his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren to the third and fourth generation. So he was passing along the principles that he had. Point number two, God planned and prophesied the extraction would take place long before the extraction event, right? So for the Israelites, you can see, and this one kind of surprised me because we think of the Exodus process or the story beginning in Exodus, but actually go back to Genesis 50, verse 24, and you will see, tail end of Genesis, we see the pre-prophesying from Joseph of the extraction. Genesis 50, verse 24 says, then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die. But God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Here Joseph was prophesying 430 years later that God would in fact rescue his people. It wasn't an accident. It was planned well ahead and God communicated that to him. We know, and again I should also point out if you're going through the notes, Exodus 6:6 as well, where God tells Moses, I'm going to extract my people, right? He was beginning the process of extraction, but he was still prophesying, I will pull my people out of Israel. We know, in 1 Peter 1, verses 19 to 20, that Christ was chosen from before the foundation of the world. God had been planning the ultimate extraction since the beginning of time, right? He communicated, he prophesied throughout the Old Testament. You see it in the New Testament. God warns and says, I will pull you out. So there's a hope there. There's something that even though you've forgotten me and you've lost your way and you no longer remember the way I established you, I will pull you out and I will extract you. It's worth mentioning that it's not a happen chance. The extraction is timed. We see for the Israelites in Exodus 12:41, that Israel left 430 years to the day that they entered in. Now, I can't stand up here and tell you what the significance of 430 is, but I can tell you that that gets mentioned not because it was an accidental, oh, look at that, it's the anniversary of the day we came in. God had a timing to it, and everything happened according to his plan. Likewise, Matthew 24:36 tells us for the ultimate extraction that God the Father knows the hour and the day that it's going to happen. Curiously, he's not told, not telling us is not surprising. He's not told Christ, but God reserves that timing for himself. So it is a very well-planned event. And we can take comfort that if he pulled the Israelites out on their 430th anniversary of their entrance, God will pull us or those who are living and are working with him out exactly at the right time when he plans to, for the ultimate extraction. God also prophesied that plagues would precede the extraction. So this is, again, still part of number two. The principle is that God tells in advance that he's going to be extracting and how he will be extracting. If you look throughout Exodus, the whole story of it, Exodus 3:20, God talks about he will strike Egypt so that the Israelites will leave. Now, there's some interesting parallel language I want to mention here. When we look at other prophecies or pre-announcements that God makes about the extraction and the suffering or the plagues that will take place, look at the language here. In Exodus 9:15, God said, well, let's turn to that one, because that one's one we don't hear very often. The language, again, is specific and very interesting. God's talking about, as he's going through the plague process, he's talking to Pharaoh, and he's letting him know this process could have gone differently, but I am in charge and I'm running this for a specific reason. So in Exodus 9:15, he says, "For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth." So God's warning Pharaoh at this point in time, by my mercy, you're still here, right? The important thing is, he's warning him, I could have wiped Egypt off the face of the earth and there would be no remembrance of it. Now think back to Matthew 24, verses 21 to 22, when God talks about the end time. He says that it will be a suffering and a terribleness, unlike anything, to the point that if Christ did not intercede, all life on earth would be wiped out. There's a deep parallel of language there that I don't have time to go into, but God's making the same statement a second time around. Like, I will not allow the destruction of life, but I could. You need to understand that, right? So it's a very parallel communication of God saying, these plagues are coming. This is what it could be you should expect. Again, interesting, I won't go to them, but if you look at Exodus 9:18, he talks about sending the worst hailstorm that had ever fallen on Egypt. In fact, when the hail came, it killed the cattle, the animals, everything that was left outside. Parallel that to Matthew 24, verse 21, and it talks about the trouble being unequaled since the beginning of time or thereafter. Again, God's paralleling the events that he led or he gave to the Egyptians to pull the Israelites out to what's happening. When you look at the two languages, you see that it's a second extraction event, only to a much greater extent. And third, this shouldn't be a surprise, when God warned of the extraction event, what did he do? He sent two witnesses. He sent Moses and Aaron. For that, you can reference Exodus 4, verses 14 to 17, where he works with Moses and adds Aaron to the mix. The parallel for the second extraction is Revelation 11, verses 3 through 6, where God talks about the two witnesses that he will send to speak to the earth, and to communicate God's message to the earth and to the inhabitants. And there's some interesting parallels when you dig into that and you research the powers that God gave to Moses and Aaron for miracles and the powers that he gives to the two witnesses. It's very similar in terms of what he gives them the ability to do to the earth. I'll let you read through that on your own. The key piece here is he doesn't just say, I'm going to extract. He says, I'm going to extract in advance, but I'm going to send two witnesses to make sure you know that I'm here, I'm the one doing this extraction, and this is how it's going to play out. Principle number three, God speaks to his people that he will extract them, but they don't listen. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise for anyone that's had children. How many times do you tell your children something? How many times did my parents tell me something? I'll say to my mom, who will probably end up watching this. You told me, I didn't listen, right? Eventually, out of mercy, we come around, but that happens even during the extraction event. In Exodus 6, verses 7 through 9, there's an interesting verse. Again, this is the type of thing I stumbled across when I was listening to Dr. Holliday. It said, but they did not listen to him because of their discouragement and harsh labor. So the first time Moses came and said, hey, I'm here to extract you, God says they didn't listen. These are the Israelites who would eventually leave, but they didn't listen. in Revelation 3:14 and through 19, read what it says about the Church of Laodicea. The Church of Laodicea, as we understand, represents at least an attitude and an era in the church right before Christ's return. And what's their message? We're good. Yeah, we don't need extraction. We got this religious thing down. We don't need to repent. And Christ says, nope, you're missing it. You think you're good, but you're lukewarm. You don't have it. When you start looking at the message that Christ gave to the churches, I suspect that there were parallels within groups of the Israelites, right? A lot of them would be represented, yes, they wanted to leave, but a lot of them would be represented by the Laodiceans in terms of attitude. In fact, you see it when they left and they said, why don't we go back to Egypt? Because we had leeks and it was pretty good there and, you know, we were happy with that. Again, I think there's a parallel between the state of the Israelites prior to that extraction, not listening, and people in God's church prior to the extraction that don't listen. Now, interestingly, because I always thought this was fascinating until I paralleled it with the big extraction, you see that Satan copied God's miracles in the beginning. The first few miracles that Moses and Aaron were commanded to do before the Israelites to show that they were God's servants, the Pharaoh's magicians did them too. Over in Exodus 7 and 8, you'll see that Aaron threw down the rod and it turned into a snake. And I, as a kid, thought, well, that's it. They're going to know what's going on. The Egyptian magicians are like, yeah, we can do that too. They threw down their rods and they made snakes. And so God's like, okay, we got to one-up this. And Aaron's snake ate the Egyptian snake. But they weren't really that impressed. Yeah, anybody can make snakes out of rods. That wasn't the only time. You look again, Moses turned the water into blood. The Egyptian magicians turned water into blood. They're like, oh, come on. Plague of frogs, third miracle that Satan copied. Moses had the frogs come up by God's power. The Egyptian magicians had frogs come up too. So you're going, okay, there's nothing special here, right? It wasn't until the lice. And when Moses brought the plague of the lice, the Egyptian magicians tried to do that, but they couldn't. And there's a fascinating, I like this verse. In Exodus 8:19, the Egyptian magicians, admitting defeat, said, this is the finger of God. Like, whoa, we can't do that. Why lice versus frogs versus blood versus snakes? I don't know. I'm sure there's a deep message to it. But the point was, the miracles that Moses was commanded to execute were copied by Satan. Now, parallel that to what it says at Matthew 24, verses 23 through 24, the second extraction. At that time, this is Christ speaking to the disciples when they ask him about the end times. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, the very elect. Right? So you've got spirit beings that are performing miracles that look just like God's miracles. So people go, yeah, that's nothing big. This guy over here can do it too. Right? Same parallel, same situation. Until it suddenly isn't. And that's when God ups it to the next level. Look also as well for later reference, Revelation 13:13. It talks about, because the beast causes fire to come down. Look at the power that God gives to the two witnesses to rain fire down from the heavens. So the beast copies the same miracle powers that the witnesses have. It's a perfect parallel with what happened with Aaron and Moses and the Pharaoh's magicians. Point number four. And this one I always looked at and I thought I found interesting. The plagues inflicted, or the first plagues were inflicted on everyone, not just the Egyptians. And then as time progresses, God separates his people out from the Egyptians. That's probably fairly well understood. But God, I suspect, allowed the Israelites to go through the first plagues because they had to remember that they needed to be pulled out. Remember, they weren't standing over pristinely in the corner having followed God's laws. They were intermingled in with the Egyptians. So when you go through it, all of them would have been affected by the water being turned to blood. The frogs, all of them were affected. The gnats, It's not clear. The flies, Exodus 8:22 tells us, only the Egyptians were affected by the flies. The cattle dying, again, only the Egyptians were affected by that, in Exodus 9:6. The boils, only the Egyptians. The hail is interesting because it was only the unbelieving Egyptians. Exodus 9 tells us there were some Egyptians that said, every time this Moses guy speaks, this bad thing happens. And they were warned, bring your animals inside, because if you leave them outside, they will die. Which means there were Egyptians, no doubt, that saw the pattern and said, I don't want my animals to die, I'm bringing them in. I may not worship this god, but I'm no dummy. So you had people that were going through the trials that were not planned to be extracted that could still benefit from listening and obeying God, listening to his witnesses. On the locusts, the Egyptians only. The darkness said specifically the Egyptians only because there was still light for the Israelites, which would really have stood out. You want to know who an Israelite is? When there's flies, you can't tell. Lice, you can't tell. When it's pitch black and you see a light on over at the Israelites' house, you know. Like when the power goes out, you know who has a power generator. And the death of the firstborn were all who failed to obey. We're going to come back to that in a second. Now, the parallel, Matthew 24, verses 6 through 13. Again, Christ is talking to his disciples for the second extraction. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. So he's talking to believers that are in this world, us now, that are seeing horrible things happen, wars and rumors of wars. But he's saying, it's not time. I haven't separated you out. I haven't extracted you. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. How many people in the body of Christ have been affected by droughts or earthquakes or anything else, right? We're not separated out. And these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to the persecutor and be put to death, and you'll be hated by all nations because of it. You can imagine being an Israelite in the midst of Egypt while these plagues are going on, and you know why they're happening, because I'm sure after the first few plagues, word got around, hey, this Moses guy's God is trying to pull the Israelites out. And our Pharaoh leader keeps saying no. I wonder what would have been like for an Israelite to live back then with these Egyptians around them. There would probably be a lot of hostility because, hey, you're the reason my cows died. You're the reason, you know, I had to get flies out of everywhere. Verse 10, and at that time many will turn away from the truth and will be betrayed and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. Again, God's people in the beginning will be suffering through the plagues at the beginning of the extraction. Now, God uses the miracles and the plagues to show the world that he is God. You'll see multiple references, and I'll just read them to you very quickly. Exodus 7:5, Exodus 9:16, Exodus 9:30, and Exodus 11:9, where God states that the reason he's doing these plagues is so that everyone will know that he is God, both the Israelites and the Egyptians. He did it out in the open because he needed people to understand his position, his authority, and his power. If you look over in Revelation 14:7, and you look at Revelation 17:7, in the interest of time, I won't go through there. You don't have to turn there, but I'll read it to you. Revelation 14:7, he says, he said in a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water. As the final extraction takes place, people will note, they won't repent, but they will note who God is and what his position of power is. In Revelation 17:17, he says, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over to the beast their royal authority until God's words are fulfilled. Talking about the kings of the earth. Like they are moved to obey God to fulfill his purpose here. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the last step of extraction is a test of those that claim to be following him. Think back to what the Israelites did with the 10th plague. They were instructed, that they had to kill a lamb in a very specific way, and they had to take its blood and put it on the doorpost. Those people that did not suffered the fate of the 10th plague. They lost their firstborn children. That was a test, right? They had to do something. They didn't just passively persist through it. Matthew 24, 12, 13 tells us that likewise with the second extraction, we have a test that we have to follow through. Specifically, he says in Matthew 24, 12, because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. Again, later he says in verse 20 and 42 and 44, as well as Matthew 24, keep watch and be ready. God's saying we have to be actively engaged in this process. We can't just be passive participants as he takes this world through what's coming. We have to do our part to be a part of it. There's a test involved for everyone. Now, interestingly, the next point was, should be point five. Uh-oh, did I get my notes wrong? Does that jive with everyone else? Yep. Okay. I didn't number the bottom of my page, which anybody that pulled that up will know is a big no-no. God's dialogue with the world, God establishes a dialogue with the world while he's going through the extraction process, prior to the actual extraction. But at the point that he's ready to begin the last process, he cuts off that dialogue. What do I mean by that? God has his witnesses. They're talking to the world. They're explaining, why are you going through all this? Is it necessary? What can I do to come out of that? We see it over in Exodus 10, verses 28 through 29. We'll turn there because that's one we don't often talk about, but it's important because it highlights a very, very important sign that we should be watching for. If you remember back to the message I gave before about transition and pregnancy, there comes that point when the pushing starts, that everything goes quiet, right? Before that, you're working through it, and you know it's transition when the woman's mood changes, and that's not the way it was. And the good news is it's about over, but it goes dark. So Exodus 10, verse 28, Pharaoh starts off the conversation. This is after the ninth plague. He says, Pharaoh said to Moses, get out of my sight. Make sure you do not appear before me again. The day you see my face, you will die. So he was threatening Moses. Moses' response, though, was in verse 29, just as you say, Moses replied, I will never appear before you again. The conversation was over. In the parlance, it was time for transition. The 10th plague would then follow, the death of the firstborn, the full extraction. At that point, there was no more dialogue between the witnesses and the world. Likewise, if you see, you can see actually two examples of it. Not only do the witnesses die, and then they're resurrected 3.5 days later, but note Isaiah 55, 6. We hear this before in other contexts, but it says, seek the Lord while he may be found, call on him while he is near. And more specifically in Amos 8, verses 11, 13, God prophesies about a famine of the word. There's a time when you can seek him, and then there will be a time when the word is no more. You won't be able to find it. You'll go hither and to and fro, and you can't find it. The communication stops, the transition period starts, and then the extraction. Point number six, and again, this one's not surprising when you look at either of them, but put them together in parallel, and it gives us a stronger image. The extraction is sudden. For the Israelites, they're told to gird up their waists, have their sandals on, eat with their staffs in their hands, because they're going to get out of there fast. And in fact, the Egyptians begged them to leave in a hurry. They said, get out of here, just leave. To the point that they didn't have time to take the yeast, the bread didn't have time to ride. It was a fast extraction. The parallels in Matthew 24, verses 16 through 20. And again, you know these scriptures, you've read them 100 times. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in the winter or on the Sabbath. So this is a fast extraction. If you can't go downstairs to get that thing, you're getting out of there fast. Point number seven. God protects and guides his people during the extraction. This is a point of hope, and I'm not really getting into the whole extraction process because 40 years of wandering through the desert and so many other things. I'm just talking about what leads up to the extraction moment. We saw in Exodus 13, verses 17 to 22, that God led the Israelites with what? A pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day, constantly reminding him that he was there, protecting them and keeping them safe. We read in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, in parallel, that after that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet with the Lord in the air, and so we will be with the Lord forever. Again, God will protect those that he's extracted. That's a good thing. There's a parallel there that we can learn in either direction. So with these seven principles, I think the days of unleavened bread, the extraction process, the exodus, if you will, gives us a fantastic vision not only of how God performed his first extraction with the Israelites, but what we can look forward to and how we should expect the second extraction with his saints on his return to come back. And it should give a much deeper color and appreciation for what God has built into his holy days with the days of unleavened bread and the Passover.